good morning and welcome to People Rise Up here on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO, in Portland, Oregon, USA, online at kboo.fm. I'm your host, Andrew Geller, and we're going to come back around again to talk about September 11th, something we've featured more times than I can recall here on this program, but we're going to be looking at something new today in that I have yet to program about September 11th in the context of solely looking at the collapse of all three World Trade Center towers. That's right, three. Buildings 1 and 2 were the really, really tall ones that everybody thinks of. But World Trade Center 7, where Mayor Giuliani's Emergency Command Center, a 47-story building, taller than I think anything here in Portland, actually, or close to it, also fell. It was admitted by its owner that it was, quote, pulled, and we'll get into discussions about how and why it couldn't have been fires that brought down either or any of those three towers. My guests this morning are Don Paul and Jim Hoffman. Together, they have written a book, a couple of books, in fact, the most recent of them being Waking Up from Our Nightmare, The 9/11 Crimes in New York City. So good morning to both of you, Don and Jim.
Thank you, Andrew.
Good morning.
Good morning. Now, there's a lot to talk about in the context of what really brought these towers down, and we'll try and get to as much of it as we can. And I think the best place to start is to talk about the fires in the towers themselves. Now, there's been a lot of study of the fires. There have been two prominent government-funded studies, that of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, and the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST. Both of those reports, in kind of tangential language, admit that the fires in the towers were not the cause of their collapse. So
both of them refused to address basically the collapses beyond the posited time that the collapses began. They just abandoned the study at the time that the explosiveness occurred.
Right, and the NIST study says they were looking at the conditions that brought about the initiation of the collapse sequence, but wouldn't look at anything after the collapse started, which, seems like, looking at only part of the issue. Now,
it's more than not, it's refusing to look at the core of the issue, because the essential issue here is how these buildings totally collapse when there's not a single case in history of a steel-framed skyscraper collapsing totally for any reason other than controlled demolition. So they completely avoid the topic that their study was funded to allegedly find out, which is how these buildings totally collapse. And instead, they explicitly truncate their study, their timeline, their analysis at the point that the buildings were, quote, poised for collapse, implying that if they're poised for collapse, then total collapse is inevitable. It's a complete non sequitur.
Well, Jim has done an excellent lengthy critique of the NIST report that's up at his site, 9/11 Research.
Yeah, it's called Building a Better Mirage, NIST's three-year, $20 million cover-up of the crime of the century.
Well, now, why don't one or both of you go through some of the details of the fires and why those fires could not have produced the collapse initiation?
I'd like Jim to handle the physical phenomena, and I'll talk about the anecdotal evidence, such as the firefighters inside.
Okay. Did you get that, Jim?
Oh, so you want to first talk about the firefighters, or you want to talk about the nature of fires and in general? And
please talk about the phenomena.
So there's lots of examples of serious fires in steel frame buildings, not unlike the Twin Towers in Building 7. And none of those have produced any kind of real collapse event, certainly not total collapse. There's the example of One Meridian Plaza in Philadelphia that burned uncontrolled for 18 hours and gutted eight floors of that 38-story building, and it didn't produce any kind of collapse. There was another serious fire in a building in Los Angeles, the First Interstate Bank building, that burned for 4.5 hours, more severe than probably any of the fires in the three buildings in the World Trade Center, and that didn't collapse either. In fact, in both of those cases, none of the columns in those buildings even needed remediation because the columns weren't even damaged. It's a property of steel that it wicks away heat. Steel is a good conductor of heat, and the temperatures that you can achieve by burning hydrocarbons in an open aspirated by air isn't anywhere near the point where it would could cause any kind of structural failure of that kind, let alone the kind of precipitous collapse that all these buildings underwent that have the characteristics of a controlled demolition, not any kind of damage that could conceivably be caused by, the random event that fires were. It's important to point out that in the case of the Twin Towers, the collapses of these buildings occurred 56 and 102 minutes after the jetliner crashes. And in the case of the South Tower, the fires appeared to be going on the verge of going out when the building suddenly exploded into dust and just systematically exploded is really the word for it. Collapse is kind of a misnomer because collapse means when something falls in on itself. But what actually happened is the Twin Towers exploded outward with tremendous explosive energy from the region around the crash zone all the way down to the ground, just systematically destroying these buildings. And so fire as a cause is just not logical at all. There's no precedent for it. There's no way that fire, being the kind of random phenomenon that it is, that could, if it could weaken steel enough, it wouldn't produce this sudden, precipitous, telescoping collapse of these buildings into themselves, because it would have, the building would have toppled or something. It wouldn't have just, systematically destroyed the building, which is what happened. In both cases, they took about 15 seconds for these buildings to just suddenly explode and just being shredded and pulverized from top to bottom.
Okay, and we'll get into more detail about the explosive nature of the events there, as well as what happened to the concrete, what happened to the structural steel members, and as a segue to you, Don, discussing some of the more anecdotal information, I want to reference that there is, let's see here, I didn't print the URL from this, but this is a May 18, 2004 article by Mark Prendergast, which leads off, quote, "Barely a half hour before the South Tower of the World Trade Center collapsed at 9:59 a.m. on September 11, 2001, none of the fire chiefs briefing the mayor and police commissioner at a meeting on a nearby street expressed concern that either 110-story building was in danger of falling. The report released that day said, quote, none of the chiefs present believed a total collapse of either tower was possible, end quote. Now, let's use that as a segue to you, Don, sharing a little bit more anecdotal information about first responders' statements regarding the fires.
Right. Yeah, that is a good segue, Andrew. I'm looking at page 24 of Waking Up From Our Nightmare. It's titled The Manageable South Tower Fires, and it references a New York Fire Department battalion chief, Orio J. Palmer, speaking to his command just 11 minutes before the South Tower went down at 9:48 that morning. And he's there on the 78th floor of the Sky Lobby, just below the impact zone. And he's there with Fire Marshal Ronald P. Bucca, and he's only reporting two pockets of fire. The actual conversation, as it was reported by the New York Times in August of 2002, goes Palmer, ladder 15, we've got two isolated pockets of fire. We should be able to knock it down with two lines. Radio that, 78th floor, numerous 1040 code ones. Ladder 15, command 478, battalion chief 7, 104, numerous civilians. We're going to need two engines up here. Then it goes on to say, Battalion Chief 7, Orio J. Palmer, I'm going to need two of your firefighters, Adam Stairway, to knock down two fires. We have house line stretched. We could use some water on it. Knock it down, okay? So they were clearly confident that they had the situation in hand a little more than 10 minutes before everything fell down on top of them. When you get into the details, you know, kind of the human drama that occurred that morning, it becomes a lot more gruesome. New York Times also printed material that the city of New York was forced to release this past August from interviews that were done with firefighters and emergency medical technicians in the first 6 months after 9/11, and they're really revealing. Jim and I have a DV that's just about ready to come out called 9/11 Guilt. The proof is in your hands, that has a section that calls these quotes and the references to explosions and specific sightings of flashes below the actual collapse of the buildings, and many people saying that they heard three loud booms, and others saying that they saw a belt-like explosion occurring about 10 floors below the actual collapse. You know, numerous observations that point to controlled demolition.
Well, and regarding that, I have one of those examples of the interviews released a little earlier this year. This is an interview with firefighter Christopher Fenyo. He was interviewed on December 11, 2001. By Battalion Chief Dennis Kenahan of the Safety Battalion of the Fire Department of the City of New York. Christopher Fenyo worked with Engine 35. Not a very long interview, but he relates information that I'll support in a moment here with a whole bunch of other accounts. Christopher Fenyo says, quote, "At a point, a debate began to rage because the perception was that the building looked like it had been taken out with charges." Skipping a part of a sentence ahead, quote, "At that point, many people had felt that possibly explosives had taken out two World Trade." Now, additionally, there is a blog site that I came across in the past few weeks. It's georgewashington.blogspot.com. Mm-hmm. You guys familiar with that?
Yes.
Okay.
I am somewhat, yeah.
I don't know about everything referenced on the site, but I followed a whole lot of the links, and it brought me to things that I was very familiar with and seemed strongly supported. There is a page from Thursday, November 10, all about witnesses to World Trade Center explosives. And I'm just going to run down this real quickly. A lot of this stuff is linked from the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm. You've got the New York City Fire Department Chief of Safety talking about bombs, many firefighters talking about bombs, explosions. The assistant fire commissioner said he saw low-level flashes like when they blow up a building. A lieutenant verified those flashes independently. A paramedic said he thought it looked like a professional demolition. Police officers noted bomb explosions and flashes of light. A British newspaper reported, quoted police saying it looked like a planned implosion. An ABC reporter talked about controlled demolition. Another ABC reporter said it looked like, quote, what anyone who has ever watched a building being demolished on purpose, quote, would see. WNYC radio reporter talked about bombs. A Wall Street Journal reporter talked about bombs, charges, and explosives. And this is fascinating, in my opinion. A facilities manager in the North Tower, quote, was convinced that there were bombs planted all over the place and someone was sitting at a control panel pushing detonator buttons, end quote. Now, the question about explosives, controlled demolition, etc., stirs up a lot of emotional, reflexive response. However, with this much independent observation, at minimum, at absolute minimum. And again, as I've done with just about all my 9/11 programming, I'd like to be proven wrong. I want the ideas we're talking about to be able to be shown that it was not demolished on purpose, that there was not intentional stand down of the military to allow these planes to do what happened. But investigation is the first step in doing this, and that has not been pursued in any credible fashion. I want to let people know they're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. My guests this morning are Don Paul and Jim Hoffman. Together they have written Waking Up From Our Nightmare, The 9/11 Crimes in New York City. And you can find out more about Don at www.wireonfire.net/Don Paul, spelled exactly like you'd think. And you can find out more about Jim Hoffman and his research at 911research.wtc7.net. And there's links to both of those sites from the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm. So using this little explanation statement regarding explosives, let's move in that direction to talk a little bit about the idea of how these towers came down. Many people are familiar with a photograph of, I guess it was the, is it the South or North Tower, where there's that 34-story block at the top that looks like it's kind of cracked and is falling off to one side. Okay, so the South Tower. It's the cover photo on Nafiz Ahmed's book, The War on Freedom. Anyone who sees it would recognize it. And one of the really bizarre things about this 34-story, over 300-foot section of the tower that appears to be falling as a uniform piece with angular momentum, it's got a twist happening, is that piece of the building appeared to vaporize in mid-air.
Yeah, Jim should handle that one, I think.
Okay,
It's very interesting that in a single photograph, really, there are multiple proofs of demolition. Just in that photograph that shows this top of the building, the top of the South Tower, starting to tilt. Because what you can see in that photograph is that you have this top 34 or 30 stories, and it's actually not not a uniform block. It actually already has a curve that's about more than 10 stories above the crash zone. So according to the official theory, all this destruction is supposedly happening because of the top of the building is supposedly acting like a pile driver and crushing itself into the crash zone, and all this crushing is happening there. But here we see that the top of the building is already broken up before it even falls into the crash zone. If you look at the videos of the falling block, it's very interesting that when it first starts, it looks like it's toppling, like a tree might topple. You know, everybody's familiar with how something topples, it starts to rotate faster and faster because there's a moment of inertia, there's a fulcrum, and it's rotating around that, gravity is pulling it faster and faster. But what the peculiar thing that happens here is that as it's starting to fall, and right before it disappears into the burgeoning cloud of dust, it actually ceases to rotate. And that violates the second law of, that violates the law of conservation of angular momentum, because barring a torque operating in the opposite direction, it would have continued to rotate faster, or at least continued to rotate at the same speed, because the only force that would be conceivable on it was at the corner that was supposedly, you know, being crushing the building, and yet it ceases to rotate. So the only explanation is that the whole thing has been broken up, and you just have the roof of the building is just kind of riding on this cloud of dust and just, you know, being buffeted and disappearing into this dust cloud. Moreover, even though this top of the building had cleared the rest of the building by a good 100 feet, you never see that any intact portion of the building emerge from below the dust cloud. In other words, the dust cloud is outracing this big intact chunk, or whatever part of it was intact. And how could that be? How could dust race to the ground faster than big chunks of, you know, steel assemblies? It was completely pulverized, apparently, before it went into the dust cloud and never seen again. No big chunks were on the street. These buildings, by the time the destruction was over, you just had 30-foot-long chunks of steel just everywhere, just blown out 500 feet in all directions. Just the building was thoroughly shredded.
Now, I just want to back up for a real quick second for the folks who got lost in the conversation regarding the conservation of angular momentum there. Basically, what you're saying is akin to the physical property of an object in motion in a straight line will continue in a straight line unless acted upon by an outside force. This is just a modification in that an object in motion at an angle will continue in that motion unless acted upon by some outside force to change its direction or stop it.
Yeah, they're exactly analogous. The idea that
destroyed a lot more property in Lower Manhattan. Just like any building hit by an earthquake topples over on its side. That's another really interesting comparison. I also think it's useful for listeners to reimagine the towers and what composed them, and then put in their minds again the collapses. The towers were 110 stories each, of course, and they had 47 central steel columns and I believe 118 perimeter columns. The central steel columns were 4 foot.
240 perimeter columns.
240 perimeter columns. And those essentially, as you say, Andrew, vaporized in less than 15 seconds. So, you know, I mean, on the face of it, it was a demolition, and that's what many people remarked at the time on that very day, that that's what it had to be, especially the people who were closest to it, like the firefighters and the emergency medical technicians. And
this is a very extensive body of evidence, these eyewitness reports. There are dozens and dozens of accounts, many of which specifically talk of impressions of demolition. And these are firefighters who are trained in the field, who know what, you know, controlled demolitions look like. And there's all these off-the-hand observations about this is what, you know, this, I thought it was a controlled demolition. And plus all these observations of features that are characteristic of controlled demolitions, like the sides of the building blowing out in all directions, and then the explosion happening before the building started to come down, you know, flashes that we talked about, this production of dust, and all these observations of features correlate very nicely with another extensive body of evidence, the photographs and videos that show these events. So yeah. There's no doubt about what happened here in terms of the characteristics, the global features of these events, and they clearly indicate demolition. But the thing that I think is really important to point out is that it's a level of destruction that it goes way beyond what you see in a conventional controlled demolition. And I think that's why most people have a hard time even thinking about this, even contextualizing it as a controlled demolition, because it's so far beyond what they are accustomed to seeing as a controlled demolition. Whereas, like Building 7, I find when people look at a video of World Trade Center 7 coming down, they immediately think, "Whoa, controlled demolition!"
Implosion.
Because it's a classic implosion. The building folds in on itself and falls straight down, producing a tidy pile of rubble. In contrast to a conventional demolition where the building is destroyed from the ground up and it's destroyed with a minimal amount of explosives, so as to fold the building in rather than blow it out. In contrast to that, the Twin Towers were exploded from the tops down, and with maybe 10 times as much energy as a conventional demolition, that they were just thoroughly shredded and pulverized. So it's even more illogical to assert that what destroyed the Twin Towers was a natural collapse event when they were broken up, shredded with far more energy than a conventional demolition.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I was about to bring up, was the difference in how numbers 1 and 2 were brought down versus number 7, in that 7 does look like a controlled demolition from the bottom up, whereas the other two appeared to operate from the top down, at least primarily. It's tough to say if there were, at this point, if there was action at the bottom. Maybe it's possible, maybe not, but in any event, it needs to be looked at. Now, the North Tower, and you have this video as a slideshow on your website, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something I'd never noticed or never investigated. And that's that the antenna of the North Tower, which is attached to the central core steel structure of the tower, moves first before any external surface of the tower begins its fall.
Right.
Now,
yeah.
I don't understand how that's possible unless there is damage being done to the central core that would allow the antenna a thousand feet off the ground to move.
Well, the official theory, of course, would be that the damage from the aircraft impact in the core was so great and the fire damage was so great that it caused the core, all these massive core columns in the region of the crash zone to suddenly collapse, you know, which is bizarre enough. But what's really interesting is that this observation about the radio tower of the North Tower starting down about a half a second before the facade of the building directly contradicts NIST's theory. That's the newest study, this $20 million study that came out this year. It directly contradicts it because the essence of their theory is that a structure called the Hatrus, which is this complicated network of beams that ran back and forth between the core structure and the outer wall. These are both load-bearing walls. The outer wall is all these columns, and then they have all these 47 steel core columns. At the very top of the building, there's this hat truss with all these crisscrossing beams that connect them all together. And according to NIST's theory, the loads being transferred by the hat truss caused the entire top of the building to come down as a plug. It just started crushing itself all at once because there was, quote, column instability that was being transferred via the hat truss back and forth between the exterior columns and the core columns. So according to that theory, they very explicitly say that the entire top of the building began to rotate as a block and then started to crush the rest of the building. They completely ignore this feature of the premature descent of the radio tower, which was firmly affixed to the very top of the central core structure and to the perimeter structure via this hat truss, which unified the whole structure.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland, Oregon, USA. My guests are Don Paul and Jim Hoffman, authors of Waking Up From Our Nightmare, The 9/11 Crimes in New York City. We'll be back after a short musical break here to talk more about the dust clouds, the molten steel, and World Trade Center 7 in specific. Stay tuned.
Planes hit in New York City, and thousands now are dead. It was Arab terrorists, so this is what you said. Well, if that is the truth, then what have you got to hide? What were you doing on the day all those people died? Where the f*** were the fighter jets ordered by the FAA? What is your explanation for what you were heard to say when you told the Air Force to stand down, not to intercept? Did you plan to let it happen, or are you just inept? There's some distressing information, sir, which I think should be explained. Just which things have been lost and just what has been gained. Like the thousands of put options bought days before the crash. If the money were collected, it'd make quite a pretty stash. And the only stocks they bought were American and United. Deutsche Bank knows the answer, but the names have not been cited. And is it just coincidence that this firm in the private sector was once run by Buzzy Krongard, now CIA director? I am left to wonder, as the flames are rising higher, was this our latest Lusitania, or another Reichstag fire?
And that, of course, is David Rovics with the beginning of his song, Reichstag Fire. You can get it online at www.davidrovics.com. You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland, Oregon, USA, online at kboo.fm. My name's Andrew Geller, and we're speaking with Don Paul and Jim Hoffman today, authors of Waking Up From Our Nightmare, The 9/11 Crimes in New York City. In the first half, we were talking primarily about how the fires in World Trade Centers 1 and 2, but we will be getting to 7 shortly, did not and could not have brought down the towers according to the laws of physics. We're talking a little bit about evidence, eyewitness evidence of explosions, bombs, flashes, etc., and a little bit how the tops of the towers appeared to come down ahead of the bottoms. Now, I want to shift gears a little bit, and welcome back to you both, Don and Jim.
Hey, thank you.
I want to shift gears a little bit here and move, sort of talking still about fires, but different fires, not the fires in the towers. I want to talk about the fires that were underneath the rubble for weeks. In fact, I have right here in front of me an article from December 19th, 2001, 4 years ago Monday, that talks about how the fires are just about out. So let's call it 4 years ago today. The fires, we can say, were out. Now, the idea that fires, which could not have brought down the towers, were able to produce heat that was able to create flowing streams of molten steel in what was described as the longest burning structural fire in history by New Scientist magazine seems like it's oxymoronic and contradictory. I don't understand how something that could not have created heat enough to melt structural steel to bring the towers down was then later able to produce heat that, you know, at minimum was able to create flowing molten steel for weeks and weeks. And in some cases, I believe specific to World Trade Center 7, showed signs that steel had evaporated, which takes significantly higher temperatures than that with which metal or structural steel is melted. Now, who would like to discuss a little bit further the idea of molten steel and how could fires have produced that type of heat in what was primarily thought to be a fairly oxygen-poor environment?
I think Jim should go first.
All right, go for it, Jim.
I think it's a deep mystery, just as this article and I think the one that you were quoting points out, of in the fact the New York Times called it the deepest unsolved mystery in the investigation, because the FEMA report, this first government report that came out in 2002, actually has an appendix that has quite a bit of interesting information about sulfidation. It's a corrosive attack of the steel by sulfur at apparently very high temperatures. It just like evaporated big pieces of steel. It wasn't clear exactly when this happened. This was steel that was recovered from the pile. And yet, this was entirely erased from NIST's report, the later report. They don't even talk about this phenomenon at all. So they just buried this whole subject of the persistent heat that went on for months in the corroded steel. So it's a very interesting topic of investigation. It's one of the things that Professor Stephen Jones, the scientist from Brigham Young University, who's gotten a lot of publicity for his paper on why did the World Trade Center towers come down. He talks a lot about this, and his field is metallurgy, so he understands a lot about it. I don't know. I don't think it's nearly as conclusive as the other evidence for controlled demolition, because for one thing, it's not completely clear that we did have molten steel in the rubble pile. The remote sensing data shows the surface of the rubble pile in places 5 days after the attack was above the melting point of aluminum, which is considerably lower than steel. And there's numerous reports of molten steel. These are anecdotal reports in the rubble pile days, weeks, even over a month after the collapses. So I think as you indicate, it's very difficult to imagine how any kind of fire with conventional fuels that were left over from the collapses could have generated those kinds of heats, that kind of persistent fires. It's just very mysterious.
Well, it lends itself to speculation as to the sources of the demolition, but the demolition remains unquestionable.
Well, I've got an article here from May 29th, 2002, the Philadelphia Inquirer, in which, let me see here, Joe Tooley O'Toole, a Bronx firefighter who worked for over 5 months at Ground Zero in the rubble pile, remembers in February of 2002, he says, seeing a crane lift a steel beam vertically from deep within the catacombs of Ground Zero, and Bronx firefighter Joe O'Toole said, quote, it was dripping from molten steel. Now, I've got Professor Stephen Jones' paper here in front of me as well, and he's got a photograph that is not dated, but it shows a piece of somewhere between orange and yellow steel from the heat being removed. He also pulls a chart showing different temperatures for different metals and the color of them at these different, or the temperature of them at these different colors. And the piece of metal that is being pulled out, my guess is somewhere between kind of like a bright orange and a lemon yellow, according to the categorizations in this chart, which gives about 1,650 to 1,850 degrees Fahrenheit, 900 to 1,000 degrees Celsius. Now, you know, this is the rubble pile, so we know that the hydrocarbon fires based on the kerosene jet fuel could not have produced heat at that level, and it's unclear if there's anything actually in the buildings that could burn at that level for that length of time. And Stephen Jones puts out a very interesting idea. Quoting Stephen Jones, I maintain that these observations are consistent with the use of the high-temperature thermite reaction or some variation thereof used to cut or demolish steel. Thermite is a mixture of iron oxide and aluminum powder. The end products of the thermite reaction are aluminum oxide and molten iron. Have either of you guys looked into thermite as being involved in any way, I'm curious?
I've thought of all kinds of possible scenarios, and I think it's likely that there were a number of different technologies, techniques that were employed for different to destroy different parts of the building. One thing about thermite is that it's a very it's very bright. It's a very exothermic reaction, and it generates a lot of heat and a lot of light. And you don't see a lot of light like flashing that kind of, you know, really bright stuff going on as the towers are blowing apart. It's just kind of a dull gray color, but it's I think it's very possible that thermite was used maybe in the cores of the buildings, maybe lower down to finish the job. Thermite takes longer to react too. It takes a few seconds to eat through a steel beam, whereas I think what we see happening at the beginning of the collapse is just a very suddenly the North Tower just starts to explode and collapse and just telescope into itself. So I don't think what's going on, at least around the perimeter columns, is anything to do with thermite. It's also important to point out that there are other analogs, like thermate, which uses sulfur instead of oxygen, and that's the thing that gets transferred in the redux reaction. So, anyway, it's pretty complicated. It's you have to know involves chemical reactions, metallurgy, and but I think. There are other possibilities that explain perhaps what happened initially. One thing that people often object to when you bring up the idea of controlled demolition is they say, "Oh, how could they possibly have rigged all those perimeter columns? There's 240 perimeter columns, and you know, they imagine how long it would take a team of people working. How could they have done that undetected?" Well, there's a technology called thermal barracks, where an explosive device has two stages of deployment. First, a charge is disperses an aerosol, and then a few seconds later, the aerosol is detonated, and by that time, it's spread out considerably. So you could have something like that happening, where there's an aerosol, the devices are deployed in the core, they're set off initially, and then when the aerosol has traveled to the perimeter of the building, the detonation occurs, and there's enough overpressure to just shatter the perimeter walls.
Yeah, my own view is probably a combination of three technologies, and I think Jim has hit on maybe the main destroyer there, but I think they probably also employed conventional shape charges, RDX. Your listeners might want to visit the site of Controlled Demolition, Inc. That's pretty instructive as to what the capabilities are, and then the co-owner of Controlled Demolition, Inc., Mark Lozeau, did an interview on New Scientist in July 24th of 2004, in which he speaks about the capabilities and kind of brags about demolitions they just carried out in New York City prior to 9/11. It's a pretty revealing interview.
Well, and there's also, and you can get to Controlled Demolition from this site that I'm about to reference, which is Wikipedia. Wikipedia, and if you just do a search for thermite, it has extensively hyperlinked description of the thermite reaction. And keep in mind, thermite is a reaction. It is not a substance in and of itself. And at the bottom of that page, it has links to a video of a thermite reaction taking place as a demonstration in what looks like someone's backyard, as well as links to a couple of different companies that utilize thermite, including Controlled Demolition. I just did a quick Google search here for thermobaric, which is thermobaric, and the BBC News website has a great analysis and explanation of what a thermobaric bomb is and how it works. Along the lines of how in the world could it have been possible to actually wire either buildings 1, 2, or 7 for a demolition job, given the complex nature of their construction? I'm not a structural engineer. I'm not a chemist. I'm not a physicist. I would imagine, however, that you would not have to set charges or whatever was involved on every single beam. You just need a critical mass and, to an extent, let the building itself do some of the work. It's important to know that 5 days before September 11th, a heightened security alert had been lifted and bomb-sniffing dogs were removed. Additionally, there were evacuation drills repeatedly in the weeks prior to September 11th. And apparently, the weekend before September 11th, which if I recall was a Tuesday, not only was electricity to the World Trade Center towers shut down, which therefore shut security cameras off, but there's documentation of workers, kind of like, you know, people who it didn't seem were like regular WTC employees running around very busily doing things. And again, you know, not quite sure what all of this means, but Marvin Bush, brother to George W. Bush, was involved in the running of a company that was involved in the security of the complex pre-9/11.
Can I back up there and address some of those points a little bit?
Please.
In terms of how buildings are rigged, in a conventional demolition, it is true that they access pretty much all of the vertical columns in the building at various levels to install cutter charges directly next to the beams, and they often do wire it together. I don't think that's how it was done at all in the case of the Twin Towers. The first thing is that I think you should imagine a completely wireless operation. I mean, you don't need any wires running all over the place. You just have little transmitters and sensors that each explosive package has picks up a unique radio signal and then responds to it. It's all computer controlled, so it's a completely wireless operation. Secondly, the Twin Towers, remember, came down with much more explosive energy than a typical demolition. Therefore, they had a lot more energy to work with. Therefore, they didn't have to get next to all those columns because they blew it up with so much more energy that they could have done the entire operation just by rigging parts of the core. Now, the core of the building was the service core, with where the central core columns were, had elevator shafts, had probably all kinds of areas that could have been accessed very easily without being detected. For instance, somebody could have used an elevator as a cart, and there's probably no security cameras that look at the blank inside of an elevator shaft. So all that could have been done on the sly very easily. There wasn't any necessity for any kind of power down, and I think that story is a red herring, by the way, that power down. If they're going to do a cabling upgrade, they wouldn't have powered down the entire, half of the building. So it could have been done, I think, very easily, surreptitiously, and using the fact that they used so much more energy to blow up those buildings, it gave them so much more leeway in terms of how they did it relative to a conventional demolition.
Yeah, to kind of recur to Building 7 and Jim's positing of the means there, the perfect position in which to set off that series of charges would be the emergency command center on the 23rd floor of Building 7. That, of course, is another reason that Building 7 was taken down, we believe.
Well, let's
see that floor. I just wanted to point out that 23rd floor bunker was about halfway up in building 7, and there was a row of windows. And from that bunker, they had an unobstructed view of the entire elevation of both of the towers, so they could monitor, they could see where the planes hit, they could see how the fires were going, they could see, they could probably reprogram their demolition sequence and do some adjustments at the last minute in case things had to go a little differently. You know, so it was the perfect
vantage
point.
It was designed to do what we think it did.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. My guests are Don Paul and Jim Hoffman, co-authors of Waking Up From Our Nightmare, the 9/11 Crimes in New York City. We've been discussing how and why World Trade Centers 1, 2, and coming up right now, number 7, came down. I'd rather talk about World Trade Center 7 than spend a bunch of time talking about the dust and concrete pulverization.
Mm-hmm.
Unless one or both of you thinks you can do it in a minute. Or I can just refer people to Jim's website, 911research.wtc7.net. There's links from the KBOO website at People Rise Up.
Can I just spend 30 seconds on pulverization?
Please.
So the Twin Towers, one thing that's important to point out is that they were 100% steel frame buildings. If you see them blowing up into dust, it looks like, maybe those were the concrete structured buildings, but no, they were 100% steel frame, and the only major concrete component was the 4-inch thick floor slabs on all 110 stories throughout these buildings. And it's very striking that the photographs of Ground Zero it's very hard to find any evidence of macroscopic pieces of concrete from all those floor slabs that were poured onto corrugated steel. They were like ripped free of just literally pulverized and dispersed all over lower Manhattan in sizes that were mostly less than 100 microns in diameter. I mean, just fine powder like talcum powder. It got into everything. And that's just remarkable that the buildings were so thorough, that all the concrete and all those floor slabs was just so thoroughly pulverized throughout the building. It indicates a systematic demolition. So I think that's just the brief summary.
Our new DVD has a lot of footage and illustrations of that. The new DVD is kind of structured like Waking Up for a Nightmare, and that Jim handles proving demolition of the three buildings, and I get into who might have been behind the demolition, the beneficiaries, and the effects thereof.
Well, we got about 8 minutes or so left here, and I would be wholly remiss to not address World Trade Center 7, which, for people who don't know, was a third World Trade Center tower that fell on September 11th. It was never hit by a plane. There's kind of differences in terms of was it hit by any debris from either of the other two towers. And the back of your guys' book has a photo of the initiation of the implosion of World Trade Center 7. And it's pretty clear that the middle of the building falls, and I guess it was about a year later, maybe many months later, that owner of the World Trade Center complex for not very long, Larry Silverstein, admitted that they, quote, pulled the tower. And in demolition parlance, pulled means intentionally demolished. So can you explain a little bit about how and why you think World Trade Center 7 was demolished?
I think the prime reason was to destroy the evidence of the operation from the command center. There were secondary reasons, financial reasons. I mean, in every aspect, this crime is multifold in its benefits, especially when you begin to look into the real estate and the insurance company profits. But that's a field we just don't have room to undertake here. I think in regard to Silverstein and the pullet, which he said on nationwide TV in September of 2002, it was a PBS documentary, I'm convinced that he meant demolition, that pull means demolished. Jim is less convinced, but I think that the physical evidence, the attributes of the collapse itself, that a 47-story building fell in 6.5 seconds, whereas a brick dropped from 47 stories would have fallen 5.9 seconds. In other words, it was just a perfect controlled demolition, make it inarguable that that's what it was, and hence we should jump to looking to the who and the why of the demolition.
Any further input, Jim?
It's also interesting that this building was across the street from the World Trade Center complex. It's a huge skyscraper. It's World Trade Center in address only. It was built 10 years after the rest of the buildings. It was owned privately from the outset, whereas the rest of the World Trade Center complex passed into private control on July 24, 2001, just 6 weeks before the attack. So how interesting that this building that was the only other building that that was an equal distance, there were other skyscrapers an equal distance from the Twin Towers, you know, surrounding the World Trade Center block. And this was the only other building owned by the same owner, and it just, you know, I wonder what this precipitous collapse, and there's all these other buildings had all this damage. We don't know exactly how much damage Building 7 had, but however much damage, even if you buy NIST's assertions that there was serious structural damage to the building, there's no way that it would have fallen straight down with such precise symmetry, in such a precise vertical fashion, which is the objective of controlled demolition. It was clearly a controlled demolition. People get that when they watch the videos of the collapse on WTC7.net.
And there was a complete lack of investigation. Andrew, when you were talking about the temperatures of the metal remaining at the Twin Towers footprints, I thought, again, that, you know, if we had had anything like a concerted investigation, we would know that. We would have all the metal measured, but that wasn't done. And in regard to Building 7, the 9/11 Commission report simply does not mention Building 7.
Well, and weren't there similar observations of high temperatures and liquid metal beneath WTC 7?
Yes, in all the throughout the site, especially where the skyscrapers were, there was this extremely high, this very high temperatures that persisted for a long time after the attack. So maybe there was some similar technology employed there. Maybe who knows, but. Yes, it's all very interesting, and the fact that they so quickly disposed of the steel in all three sites. Not only the Twin Towers, where they had the excuse that they had to get rid of the steel as quickly as possible to hopefully find some survivors, but there were no people thought to be trapped under the rubble of Building 7, and yet they just shipped all of it off to Asia as fast as they could get it out of there, and prevented the alleged investigators from even examining the steel. They weren't even allowed access to Ground Zero except for what they described as a tourist trip.
Well, arrested people were taking snapshots.
Well, and earlier in this conversation, Jim, you referenced 30-foot lengths of steel, which I think is a very important point to note.
The apologists for the official story will say that the prefabricated sections of the Twin Towers were in 36 foot lengths. But if you look at the Ground Zero, you see that they're ripped apart in all kinds of different random lengths. They don't correspond to those prefabricated sections. And plus, the core columns are just, everything is shredded into less than 50 foot long lengths, making it very easy to load them onto trucks. So it's just the whole thing was just the steel skeletons of the Twin Towers were just thoroughly shredded into, like, no more than 50-foot lengths. Building 7 was more, like, folded up into longer lengths, but so it wasn't as thoroughly shredded as the Twin Towers. But in all cases, I mean, you know, just the completeness of the destruction is yet another of many features of controlled demolition. No kind of natural collapses would have caused such total destruction of these buildings. You know, just there was nothing left except for the shards of the Twin Towers or the bottom parts of the perimeter columns sticking up.
What's interesting now is this has become so well known and accredited with Stephen Jones' paper and David Griffin speaking out about it and so forth. So I feel really encouraged from where it was in 2001, 2002 when 9/11 Facing Our Fascist State came. Phenomenological support other than a couple of articles on the Internet.
So we're just about out of time here, and I am curious if you guys have advice for folks who are interested in taking this information further. I've heard critiques of, the reports have been out, the 9/11 truth movement is kind of lagging, there's not real opportunity to take this further. I know that yesterday Senator Barbara Boxer said, we gotta find out about what's going on with this.
Yeah, form a citizen's grand jury in your own community and, you know, bring it together in a public forum and, you know, examine the evidence and see what you find, and, you know, try to excite the public, because my experience, I think it's Jim's too, is that the public is really receptive when you come to them in a kind of open-hearted way and say, "This a terrible crime's been committed, and we don't know the answers, but here's what's obviously happened. We need to do something."
And I would just point out that you don't need to be a rocket scientist, you don't need to be a physicist or anything like that to understand that these were controlled demolitions. It's very obvious, and people tend to think, "Oh, I don't have the means to evaluate it." But look at the evidence. Just go and look at the photographs and the videos, and it's just glaringly obvious that these were controlled demolitions. These buildings were intentionally destroyed, and this is the heart of the crime. So I think this is the thing. Don't get distracted into it. And there's so many distractions going on with people with all kinds of bogus theories about what happened on 9/11. Focus on what the core of the crime, what's obvious. You know, if you just open your eyes and look at it,
and it where it leads.
All right. Well, I really appreciate you both taking time out of your morning to join us here on KBOO to talk about how World Trade Centers 1, 2, and 7 came down.
I want to thank you, Andrew, for being on it for so long and, you know, staying on it.
Oh, well, my pleasure. It's fascinating research and really interesting reading. And I think it's important, as you both reference, Don Paul and Jim Hoffman, co-authors of Waking Up from Our Nightmare, The 9/11 Crimes in New York City. These were crimes. These were not acts of war. These were crimes.
2,000 people plus killed.
Yeah, and there is no statute of limitations on murder charges, which I think is important to reference and remember. You can find out more about Don Paul online at www.wireonfire.net/Don Paul. And for Jim Hoffman, you can go to his website, 911 Research. That's the numerals 911, the word research, WTC7.net. Thank you both very much for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you have any comments or questions about anything you heard today or any other day here on KBOO Radio, People Rise Up, you can send email to me at kboo@riseup.net. You can also send regular paper mail to me here, Andrew Geller, KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. The People Rise Up website at kboo.fm. If you go to the program schedule, click on Wednesday morning, 10 a.m., People Rise Up has links to more than you probably would want to read. But maybe not. Lots and lots of information, references to just about everything we discussed and utilized in the conversation today, so do please check it out. Thank you very much for listening to today's program.